volunteer for these kinds of roles, and we thank you. Thanks very
much.
Thank you
for taking the initiative.
Thank you. Okay, we have a panel. I want to start calling some invited testimony. I'd like to start with Steve Entler from Radio Cab on behalf of the Transportation Fairness Alliance. Come on up, please, Steve. Afternoon.
No.
As you said, my name is Steve Antler. I'm the general manager at Radio Cab and also here representing the Transportation Fairness Alliance today. Every branded taxi company in Portland abides by two regulations imposed by the City of Portland to uphold three public obligations: 24/7 service, full city coverage, and wave service. When first mandated, these pillars of service didn't originally fit into our business model, but we follow them, and quite frankly, it's a good policy. Uber and Lyft will assure, promise, and cajole that they, too, are providing these legal obligations to the public, but they're not. They don't consistently provide them anywhere across the globe, so why would it be any different here in Portland? It isn't. The original purpose of the task force, the public was told, was to ascertain if Uber would be a fit in Portland. It quickly morphed into a question of how Uber would fit into Portland, or rather, how can we modify Portland's regulatory scheme for providing transportation services so that it appeases Uber? We've heard it claimed that Portland is a model for how it is dealing with Uber. Pardon me, but Portland is actually a model for how Uber makes its way into a market and gets everything at once. The California-based taxi companies have convinced you that they do not need to be held to the same regulations that branded taxi companies do. You are even extending the so-called trial period by 120 days to allow them to dig deeper into this market. Uber has long contended that it is not a transportation company, but a technology company, and therefore should not be regulated by the city's taxi code. That was its premise when it entered into Portland last year, blatantly refusing to apply for a taxi company permit. However, its desire to operate here was stronger than its basic premise, so it agreed to enter into the task force process. However, Uber still insisted that it was fundamentally different from traditional branded taxi companies. It insisted that it needed special regulations as a so-called TNC. We in Portland's traditional taxi companies objected vociferously and demanded that any regulations specifically designed for Uber be designed to create a level playing field and declared our motto as same rides, same rules. We have long argued that no matter what Uber calls itself, its only difference is that it operates unbranded taxis. Uber states that it's unbranded taxi drivers and independent contractors, but so are most of Portland's branded vehicle drivers. Uber says it's unbranded taxi drivers own their own cars. Well, so do most of Portland's taxi drivers. Uber says it's unbranded taxis are dispatched by a smartphone app. Well, so are many of the city-branded taxis. Most of us even have our own apps. Like the unbranded taxi drivers, branded taxi drivers are paid through smartphone apps, but branded taxi drivers also accept cash customers, street hails, and stand fares. Incidentally, it's our understanding that Uber and Lyft are not supposed to take cash customers, hay tails, or wait on taxi stands as a way of leveling the playing field. But guess what? There are numerous documented incidents in which Uber and Lyft drivers are blatantly disregarding these regulations. By the way, who's watching them anyway? And why is any of this important? Because the city had decided years ago that the taxi industry had a crucial role to play in Portland's transportation scheme. A public need existed for transporting citizens without their own cars, including citizens with disabilities, those who live outside the Central Core, and those who need short, economical rides. All of this required a system of branded companies that had a 24-hour dispatch and could provide transportation for all. In order to make these requirements financially possible, a limit was placed on the number of vehicle permits. Although the system was not perfect, it did provide the required transportation services. Then came Uber and Lyft, their army of lobbyists, and the task force. The city eliminated the cap, resulting in severe economic blow to the branded taxi industry, especially the smaller companies, not to mention drastic reductions in branded taxi cab drivers' incomes, large number of which are immigrants. So the question before the city council now are how to maintain those needed transportation services to citizens with disabilities, the elderly, those who live in the fringes of their city, those with need for short rides, and those who need transportation at odd hours at night. What we in the branded taxi industry maintain is that the obligation to the public must be shared equally between the branded and unbranded taxis. All companies providing transportation services in the city must be required to step up to the plate with more than lofty goals or idle promises. So far, we have not seen Uber or Lyft actually provide more than token wave service. All too often, requests for vehicles are responded to by no vehicles available message showing up on the smartphone screens. How is that serving the public? Additionally, a huge need, which you've already identified, exists to adequately protect passengers and innocent third parties who may become involved in accidents. The branded taxi industry, even the smallest companies, provide commercial liability insurance coverage 24 hours a day. We pay for the coverage for our independent contractors. The unbranded multi-billion-dollar companies need to do the same. Passing this responsibility off to their drivers is not a responsible option, either for these companies or for the city regulators. Portland's branded taxi industry has been diligent in trying to help the transition to a system that regulates both branded and unbranded taxi companies, and we offer our technical expertise, the value of our experience, and the time and effort it will take to make the system work so that all citizens can obtain the transportation services they need and deserve. We still hold out hope that the city will establish a level playing field for all market players. Is anyone listening to us? We're making some pretty important points. I thank you for allowing me to comment. If you have any questions you'd like to ask.
Thank you. Any questions at this point?
Mr. Handler, yeah, I had two questions. One is, although you argue it's not being sufficiently enforced, and we can try to address that, by law, the TNCs are not allowed to accept street hails. They're not allowed to line up at taxi stands. And the traditional taxis are. What percentage of your business do you think comes from street hails from taxi stands?
Well, you kind of asked me that in our meeting early this week, and I said I can only look at it from a radio cabs aspect. And our company has a kind of a different model than most of the rest of the cab companies, in that I would say probably 80 to 90% of our business comes through our dispatch system. And any of you that drive around, take a look at what's sitting on cab stands or hotel stands and stuff, will see that most of the time it's some other cab company that's sitting there. It's not very very often you see a radio cab. Same thing applies out at the airport. Very few of our cabs are in the on-demand line. But that being said, it probably had a pretty large effect on most of the cab drivers, and it'll be different for individual drivers depending on the shifts that they typically work. You can't add 2,500 vehicles to the streets of Portland without having a huge effect on the average cab driver's income.
On the effect, that's the other question I had. At one point, you said that you thought that Radio Cab had lost something like 6 to 8% of its business since the advent of the pilot, and Broadway said that it lost something like 30 to 40%. And I was puzzled as to why there'd be such a huge discrepancy in the impact of the two companies. Can you give me any thoughts on that?
Well, and I went over that too. I said a lot of it has to do with our business model. We market for our drivers, and most of it comes through the dispatch system. And the other thing is you were asking at the last meeting a specific month, and I was going by dispatch data, and which is trip counts. I can't tell you how much each one of those trips is worth, but that was a specific time during the month of May, which is right after the pilot project started, and a lot of those additional TNC drivers weren't on the street at that time. So I think I gave a quote of about 6 to 8% difference. Now it's down more, I'm sure. I didn't bring the numbers with me, but it's probably more like about 15 or 20%.
I have a
question. Sir, actually, first to Steve. Steve, was the last taxi company that we permitted, was that Green Cab?
I think it was EcoCab.
EcoCab. Yeah. It is a green cab, but an EcoCab. Okay. So,
in a different way.
I believe that's the last one that went through the gauntlet and got a permit before we went to a, before we entered into this pilot period. So my question to you, sir, is there a way to quantify the difference in the costs that a taxi company incurs under the then existing rules before the pilot, and then assuming they had been permitted during the pilot period?
I'm not sure I fully understand that question, but I actually would like to bring up something that's a little bit more pertinent to my company right now, which is, what do we do about our annual permit, which comes up here in about a month and a half? Now, Radio Cab has 155 Portland permitted cabs, and we pay at a rate of $600 per vehicle plus a $3,000 per annum company permit for 155 vehicles. I just heard testimony that 2,500 additional drivers and vehicles had been added, and that comes out to about $1.5 million, which they paid $20,000 for. Something's a little bit wrong, and there needs to be an adjustment.
So my question may not appear pertinent, but there's method to the madness. Let me go back.
Okay, go ahead.
Commissioner Novick earlier said he wants to take a look at the question of what was the cost incurred by companies complying with the 20% rule.
Oh, yeah. I was going to.
He and I share this concern. People who followed one set of rules and incurred the cost of complying with those regulations versus the new, fairly unregulated environment and the cost of compliance.
Right.
And I'm curious, in addition to the 20% rule, is there a way to quantify the difference in costs under the old rules, the new rules, for traditional taxi companies?
I would have a difficult time with that. The wheelchair accessible vehicle difference might be a little easier to delineate.
Well, flag that one. But let me make it as an open-ended question. I'm trying to lead the witness, even though I may not be perceived.
Go ahead.
It may not be seen as pertinent. I would be interested beyond.
What do you want to say?
Beyond the wheelchair accessible vehicle question. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to know what other costs would EcoCab or anyone else have incurred under the old rules that they would not have had to incur under the new rules, since I think there's an inequity about changing the rules after you've established them for one class of providers and then new rules for everyone else. So I'm inviting any additional information in the future that you have for us beyond the 20%
rule. First of all, there's very little change for us. The regulations for the cab industry remain functionally the same. There's a few little tidbits here and there where they've allowed different kind of training and different kind of background checks. It was up to the companies. But 90-some-odd percent of the code still remains intact. And the average, if you're going to compare one industry against the other, it's pretty easy to put just a car on, do nothing, and you got a smartphone. And the cost for a cab and all the ingredients go for a cab company are astronomically different. Yeah.
So, Commissioner Novick, for companies whose annual permit is coming up, will they be required to pay it or what?
I think the answer is yes, and the question is whether we adjust the permit fees that we're charging the TNCs. However, if somebody has a suggestion as to how we can make a very quick change to the current rules, I'm willing to listen to it.
Well, it does, and I do think I was correcting 20,000, right? Was the
yes, 20,000 per company, maybe.
Per
I'm
company,
not sure.
Yes.
But that unlimited amount of vehicles and drivers, and I wasn't sure what that number was until I just heard it.
Well, and I'm understanding that this extension is already happening. That's not a question before the council today, but I am worried about the costs to the city and the taxpayers for continuing this experiment without proper reimbursement. So could we consider charging the TNCs more for the additional trial period?
Um, Let's see. Let me ask.
Let's put that question on the table and hear from the rest of our.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to inquire with the lawyers as to what we have the legal authority to do immediately. I think that, I mean, what we're moving to is a model of full cost recovery. So the permit fees should be related to that. So as soon as we can come up with a formula that meets those goals, the better.
So maybe as we proceed, we could flag questions for either staff or the task force.
Well, the principle that I thought we were doing this pilot on was that it should be this roughly the same for the different types of organizations. And I remember that we waived some kind of individual driver permit fees for the taxi drivers for the course of this. So it doesn't seem fair to charge one company a whole load more than the others.
Okay, good point. Thank you. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
Okay, let me call the next couple of invited speakers, Brooke Steger and Annabelle Chang, representing Transportation Network Companies. Come on up. Good afternoon. Whoever would like to go first?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, members of the council and mayor. I am Annabelle Chang, Lyft's West Coast Public Policy Manager, and we wanted to thank the Private for Hire Innovation Task Force, the staff at PBOT, and your staff for working on this issue for so, so many months. During this pilot period, thousands of Portland residents have been connected through TNC apps, providing mobility options to many, many people who did not have those options before. So we really appreciated the time and the effort that the task force put into this, and we appreciate, again, in the phase two of the task force, the ability to participate and provide some of our perspective from the industry side. So I just want to address some of the outstanding issues that we'd like to discuss. I think we've definitively raised the bar in terms of way of access for residents across the city of Portland, but there's still some remaining questions on how can we best serve the community. So I just wanted to say that now that we're operating in the city and seeing firsthand the logistical hurdles of wave access, I wanted to kind of discuss how that actually works. So for us to be in the pilot, we have partnered up with local wave providers, Ride Connection and Wapato Shores. Now, these relationships are based on hourly fees. So what does that mean? So it means that in order for us to have availability of wave cars, you actually pay for the hour that they are available, which is actually the most meaningful way for someone to actually get a ride, because what that means is when they turn on their app, they'll have a wave vehicle able to connect with them. So that is different. It's not a 20% fleet percentage. It is actually about having that vehicle available. But then again, the cost is very significant. And so the question is, how do we make this meaningful so that people are actually connected from rides to the providers? So we were really pleased to see that the task force came up with the accessibility fund. We also agree with the Commission on Disability that is the right idea, and those alternatives are going in a positive direction that I think will improve wave access for residents across the city. We also want to talk briefly about insurance. So we strongly agree with the task force's recommendations. These insurance standards were set nationally, and they have been adopted by states all over the country. And we believe that they provide adequate and have proven to provide adequate safety for not only residents and passengers and drivers. So to be crystal clear, we are primary in the period one phase. So for additional feedback, we've also given Commissioner Novick written feedback on street hails, trade dress, and mechanic certifications, and late night availability and pricing. And we're happy to talk about that further as well. So thank you again for your time.
Okay, just to be clear, is Lyft primary in periods 1, 2, and 3?
Yes, we are. All TNCs must be primary in period 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, and in addition, what is your view about whether it's commercially reasonable for us to require that there be $1 million liability coverage in period 1, 2, and 3?
So I think that's a good question that has been discussed for probably a year or more. And so the conclusion of those discussions was that the 5,130 primary in period one was adequate, and that $1 million in two and three provided also adequate. Now, I just want to be very clear that periods two and three, we have double the insurance limits of taxis in the city of Portland.
But is there any question in your mind that we have the authority to regulate those minimums?
No, there's no question in my mind that that is possible.
And to the extent that someone is injured in period one or potentially very seriously injured, as a company, what would you say to them if they needed coverage that exceeded the $50,000 limits?
So it obviously depends on a case-by-case basis.
All right, well, let's say it inadvertently, unfortunately, someone dies. I mean, there are going to be instances where we're operating under actuarial rolls of the dice. What would your company say if someone was grievously injured and there wasn't adequate insurance coverage in the period one? Because that's really, we're putting the human face on this.
Absolutely.
It can get very abstract.
And I think those are very important questions. You know, it even comes down to what are the limits for personal insurance, right, for a driver. So I think those are similar questions. I mean, we'd be happy to discuss it further.
Do you have any reason to believe that the marketplace would not provide up to $1 million of liability coverage in period one for Lyft?
We have not seen it available at this point.
And have you sought it? Have you asked?
Of course we have.
When you say you haven't seen it available, what kind of outreach have you done to reputable commercial insurance companies?
That question has certainly been asked.
But Ms. Chang, I do think, I mean, to Commissioner Fish's point, I mean, have you called up an insurance company and said, we want to buy $500,000 or $1 million worth of insurance for you from period one? Will you give it to us at a price that we can negotiate? And if they said no, we refuse to sell you that level of insurance at that price?
So to be clear, that obviously is a private business negotiation, but that question has certainly been asked. So I'm saying that those discussions have taken place.
Colleagues, yes. If we can require $50,000, we can require $500,000. I think this is an academic discussion, and the council needs to decide what is most safe for the citizens of Portland.
Good point. Ms. Steger.
Thank you so much for having us today. I just wanted to applaud the task force for all of their hard work. As you guys have pointed out, they've put in an extreme amount of hours. I had the privilege of sitting on a number of the subcommittees and saw all of the hard work and thought that they have put into this, so I definitely want to applaud them for being amazing citizens of Portland, and also for you for all of the thought and work that you've put into this. I realize it's been a bit of a long road, and it continues, and we look forward to continuing to work with you. Overall, we feel that this program has been a success. We've seen over 2,000 small businesses start on our platform and provided over 400,000 rides in the city of Portland. We believe that that has directly contributed to taking drunk drivers off the road, to helping take people out of their personal vehicles and into public transportation, onto their bikes. We also launched Uber Pedal here in Portland a few months back, and we look forward to continuing to be a part of that fabric here in the city of Portland. We've also been deeply committed to the compliance efforts for the pilot program. Every driver has to be inspected by NASE or a Blue Ribbon certified mechanic. We've only found two mechanics that we've been able to partner with so far in the city, but have stayed true to that. And every time a driver is inspected, they are required to sign up for that business license. They are given a first aid kit and a fire extinguisher and a hands-free device. We have stuck to those very, very readily. And as the City of Portland employee pointed out, every driver does have to have a business license before being activated on our program, as well as have their vehicle inspected and a background check and MVR check passed. We also do provide primary insurance in periods 1, 2, and 3, as Annabelle pointed out. I think Portland has also taught us a lot of valuable lessons. We just opened up our permanent office here in Portland and have 5 full-time employees and look forward to growing that. We've also seen a ton of partnerships we've actually partnered with almost 100 small businesses here in Portland, connected neighborhoods, partnered with nonprofits, and look forward to continuing those partnerships. And that's really why we put teams on the ground and why that's so important to us. We look forward to primary regulations in October. and look forward to working with you on changes to the existing pilot program. One of the biggest and most systemic problems in Portland, we believe, was the wheelchair accessible accessibility here in the city. And I'm not saying that we have been perfect in that solution. There's still a ton of room for improvement. But we have partnered with First Transit. We are offering service. There are gaps in that service that need to be filled, and we are working with them to fill those gaps. They have committed to providing us with 24/7 service. And again, as Annabelle pointed out, those are hourly. We do pay those drivers hourly, so we are committing a significant amount of funds to ensure that that happens. Furthermore, Portland is the first city in the entire world where Uber has launched P2P wheelchair accessible option, an option. This was not easy. It took a lot of time. We had to deal with there were special insurance negotiations that had to happen. We actually, even though it's outside of the regulations, we put forth additional inspections for those vehicles and additional training in person for those drivers. And so there's only four currently on the platform. But we look forward to that growing, and it's truly momentous, and I applaud the team for so much hard work that they put into making this happen. And this is a first for Uber in the entire world. So it's a huge deal, and we're very, very proud of it, and we look forward to growing that. I don't think it's an end-to-end solution, but I do think it's a step in the right direction, and I also we do support the task force's recommendations on creating a fund, and we look forward to working with them and making sure that those funds are used to actually solve the problem and move this forward. Lastly, we're just very excited to continue to work with you to find a permanent home and to continue to grow the team, support the thousands of small businesses we already are, and take tens of thousands of riders home safely.
So when you both of you mentioned you pay your wheelchair accessible providers an hourly fee, so I'm not sure I understand that. Are you saying you pay them, I don't know, take one driver, one wave driver, you pay a 24-hour fee to that company to make sure there's at least one driver available in that 24-hour period?
That's correct. So currently, we are reliant, obviously, on the supply that currently exists in a market. And so we pay we partner with First Transit. We pay that company. They arrange the drivers. Those drivers work for or partner with First Transit. And First Transit is our partner. And we pay an hourly fee to that company in order to ensure those drivers are on the road.
So you pay the fee prospectively. It's not something they invoice for you afterwards and say, we actually, I don't know, provided 8 hours of the day, but sorry, we couldn't cover the other 12 or 14 hours.
We have a contract with them that outlines we work with them to negotiate a contract, outline which hours they can be on and agree to be on. And I will say it has been difficult to have for them to create a 24/7 solution, mm-hmm. something that they've been working very hard on and have committed to delivering. In the contract, we negotiate which hours they will be on, which hours they can potentially be on. A lot of these vehicles, especially during the day, for example, are used for non-emergency medical transportation and non-emergency medical transportation trips. And so it's very important that there is supply available for that as well. So it's navigating the path for this to find supply for the for-hire transportation.
So do you – oh, sorry.
Well, I was going to switch gears to just having drivers available 24 hours, 24/7. I mean, I guess that's been another issue I've heard. You know, this thing, you get something on your iPhone says, sorry, nobody's available. So do you have incentives to have drivers serve those odd hours? I mean, do you pay them incentive pay or a higher take less of their cut, anything like that?
Are you referring to Wave or?
No, I'm not referring to Wave. I'm just referring to general 24/7 coverage for anybody that desires to use Uber or Lyft.
So, from Uber's perspective, I think that's something we explored in cities early on, but now we are able to meet and ensure that because of the amount of partners that we have on the platform and because of the dynamic pricing, we are able to see and ensure that there are vehicles on the road at all times. As PBOT pointed out, there are trips being completed 24 hours a day. We see 24/7 coverage here. We also supplied some numbers to the city to show that, yes, there are drivers on the platform between those hours of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. Furthermore, dynamic pricing actually encourages that. It is that exact incentive that you're speaking to. So when dynamic pricing is available and on, drivers can see this, they can access that information, and they know that supply is essentially lower than the demand is, and it encourages drivers to come on the road and complete trips.
You don't currently do surge pricing?
There is currently surge pricing. And
there is.
That's correct. We did not launch with that, but we, as when you're trying to do that supply and demand balance equation, when you first launch a city, obviously there's a ton of latent demand in a city, and so you want to wait and ensure that you can build up supply to a point that is adequate to meet that. And we obviously have an algorithm that runs in the background that determines what that supply and demand equilibrium is, and that was turned on, I believe, 2 months ago.
Ms. Steger, I can't remember if it was you or some other representative of the company. It was my understanding that in the middle of the night you haven't been using surge pricing because you haven't found it necessary. So between like 2 and 6 in the morning, you haven't been using surge pricing.
That is not to my knowledge. If you don't see dynamic pricing enabled when you open the app at 2 a.m. or 2 p.m., that means that there's an adequate balance of supply and demand.
But you don't know whether it's true, what I was told before, that you generally haven't been having dynamic pricing in the middle of the night.
That is not something that we have ever put into effect.
What do you mean? You haven't ever put into effect surge pricing in the middle of the night?
We've never. So we don't control. It's either surge price, dynamic pricing is either on or it's off. So if it's on, then if supply is lower than demand, then dynamic pricing will go into effect automatically. I don't have the ability to say, okay, surge pricing is turned on, but not between these hours.
Okay, but in practice, do you have data on whether you've been using surge pricing in the middle of the night? Because what I was told is that in practice you had not.
I am not 100% sure. I would say typically we typically see dynamic pricing go into effect at the end of a large event, Friday night around 11 or 12 p.m. It is atypical that you will see dynamic pricing in effect between the hours of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. That's across the board here in Portland as well as in Seattle.
I have a number of questions.
Just before you do that, I want to finish on this one. But Commissioner Novick suggested at the beginning that we might ban you from using dynamic pricing from between 2 and 6 a.m. Does your technology allow you to switch it off between 6 and 2 and 6?
It does not.
Yes?
It does not.
That was for Wave, wasn't it?
We'll come back. So I have a couple of questions that I'm going to address to both of you, and just if I could get a yes, no, or if it doesn't lend itself to that, we can discuss it a bit. Let's start with business licenses. First, Uber, then Lyft. Are 100% of the drivers on your platform in compliance with our requirement that they obtain a valid Portland business license?
Yes.
And Lyft?
Yes, we had to sign that under penalty of perjury for a permit.
That's the lawyer in you saying that. on the service agreements, the long, complicated documents that no one ever reads, but they always check online that they've read and agree to its terms. Have you, since you were here 4 or 5 months ago, have you tailored your service agreements to conform to Oregon law? First, Uber.
When this topic came up before, and I will preface that I'm not a lawyer, but I believe in our service agreement it does state, and I think that this is common, that any state or local law will supersede a service agreement. So should a city law exist or a state law exist, just because our service agreement may be in slight conflict with that, the law that's in place supersedes whatever is in a service agreement, so it's absolutely in compliance with state and local law.
So I'm a recovering lawyer. I used to be a lawyer, but I don't do it anymore. And let me just urge you, because the service agreement is designed to provide notice to your customers of the ground rules, I don't find it very comforting that a typical customer would have to go get a lawyer to find out which clauses actually apply or don't or are superseded. So the one way I think you could give excellent customer service is to have a service agreement that's tailored to Oregon law so that there isn't a question about whether any of the clauses apply. And I'm just going to renew my request that you consider that. I think it's
in some ways a reflection of your values as to whether you want to put out information that's inconsistent with Oregon law. And since all we're talking about is having someone scrub it so that anything that's inconsistent you remove rather than have a catch-all clause that says it may or may not apply depending on Oregon law. I view this as a pro-consumer thing, so I'll just renew my request that you consider that. Dan Saltzman was the third vote to move forward with this trial, so I was a little surprised that Uber has proposed that we eliminate the requirement for a fire extinguisher, which was one of his amendments. I'm just curious, what is it about a fire extinguisher that is a problem for the driver or for the company?
Sure. I think, one, I would like to point out that every driver has a fire extinguisher in the vehicle, and that is passed out at the point of vehicle inspection. Our largest concern is the precedent that that sets. If there is an emergency and there's a rider in the vehicle or the driver is in the vehicle, we want that rider and that driver to exit the vehicle and call 911. We do not want a driver to feel that because they have a fire extinguisher in their vehicle, that is their it is their responsibility to then take it upon their own hands to put out a fire. We want them to call 911 and go to safety. I think that that's very actually fair when you put a, I guess that's my question to the commission too, is what is the intent of putting a fire extinguisher in the vehicle and what would you like those drivers to use that fire extinguisher for?
As of now, you're in compliance.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know the answer. Dan can speak for himself, but it reminds, it's sort of like, why do we have a kit in the car to containing bandages and ointments and other things? We're not suggesting that people be nurses and doctors, but it's a backup. And it's an additional safety measure, and I'll leave it to Dan to propose that. But it's something that Dan proposed, the council agreed to, and if it does in some way become a problem, I'd ask you to put it in writing and explain to us practically how it's a problem. And then finally, there's been some news stories across the country of people who've fallen through the cracks on background checks, and in any system, a background check is not going to be perfect. After all, I'm an example of someone who slipped through the electorate and got placed on this body. So no system is completely safe, foolproof. So my question to you is, in light of the documented stories across the country of bad actors passing a background check and placing the public at risk, what assurances can you give people in Portland, in the Portland metropolitan area, that your drivers are safe?
So from Uber's perspective, we have been following the background check requirements laid forth by this commission. Those background checks, a subset of every driver, is turned over and then reviewed by PBOT. So we think that that process is a good one, and we're happy to continue to do that. So we think that there is a checks and balances system there. Furthermore, we are akin to the same requirements as taxi here in the city of Portland. We go 10 years back on the background check. The requirements, you know, if you have a violent crime conviction, they will be excluded from going onto the platform. So I think that the standards are actually very, very similar, and we'll see the same things. I can also say that no background check, as you pointed out, is perfect. There are examples across the country of all kinds of background checks having things fall through the cracks. For example, in Seattle, we actually have denied approximately 8% of taxi drivers who go through a live scan check. In the state of California, there's over 600 people that made it through the California taxi process that have been denied to drive on the Uber platform. And there are over 475 livery drivers, which is similar to a chauffeur vehicle here in Portland, that have been denied on the platform for failing a background check. So you see holes on both sides.
So how many have you denied in Portland?
I do not know the exact answer to that. I would say it's probably between 5 and 15%.
I'm
happy
to
get an exact number for you.
Thank you.
How about our friends at Lyft?
Absolutely. We follow all of the requirements laid out by the city. And on top of that, because we're in such close reporting partnerships with PBOT has basically daily information about drivers. They also do receive any complaints and concerns. So if anything does come up, that can be addressed immediately. So we do firmly stand behind our background check provider, Sterling Backcheck. I was actually on a series of meetings this week where I actually had our vice president of compliance to speak to cities, speak to regulators, and talk through how that process works from the very beginning of running the official name, the driver's license, the social security number, past addresses. It's a very comprehensive background check that's national and goes down to the local databases.
I guess my final question is, someone showed me on an app the other day that as you move away from the central city, you're more likely to get a reading that there's no available car for a WAVE customer. Why is that?
So for our example, we currently partner with Wapato Shores during the weekdays. Their office is located in the center of town. And so basically what happens is because we are, as Commissioner Salzman was asking, we are paying them hourly to be available, they essentially sit at that office location with the app available so that they are able to take a request. Because in general, we are submitting data showing how the waves are requested, how they are fulfilled, and it'll be very clear that based on the data, demand actually is pretty limited. And so, in essence, the wave drivers are typically sitting idle.
And
Uber?
We have a similar response. There's, I believe, the last data we submitted, there was approximately one trip a day, and the cars are, for the most part, sitting idle.
When you say one trip a day, does your data take into account people that have got a reading on their phone that says there's no car available?
Yes, absolutely. So what that means is even if you turn on the app and the WAVE vehicle is 29 minutes away, it'll still show that you can actually request that vehicle.
But the app that I saw showed that as you got closer to 82nd, it was more likely to pop up no vehicle available. So that's not a request. So we wouldn't know whether that person, we wouldn't know what the service level for that person was. And I just have to impress upon you, and this is anecdotal. This is just someone taking out their phone and walking me through this. But it was kind of uncanny. The farther you got from downtown, the center of the city, the greater the likelihood that there was no WAVE vehicle available. And that is triggering some very dearly held values in this community around equity. You're talking about people that don't live in the central city, maybe disproportionately low income, maybe disproportionately people of color, and if they have a disability, they're no different than anyone else who has a disability. And so if the system does not provide parity to people by zip code, we have a problem. And I'm going to want to know how we address that problem going forward.
And may I briefly address? So I think that's where the Accessibility Fund is a really profound idea, because I think what the issue is how do we match the number of WAVE vehicles actually available to give a ride to the people who want the ride. And the issue is many of the 20% of the taxis who are WAVE accessible vehicles are actually being, for example, contracted for non-emergency medical transport. Similar to our partners, they also have non-emergency medical transport contracts in place that pay very, very well. So the issue is, for us, the concern is availability, right? And I think that once we can basically pool all of these resources together and essentially have true accounting of the WAVE vehicles available, we will address that. The city will address it in the best way possible.
Can I jump in here?
Absolutely.
It was my understanding from a conversation the other day that you don't know how many times somebody has opened up an app and they haven't made a request, but it shows no vehicle available. But I think that Ms. Deger at least said that you could put something that for WAVE requests, you could put something on the app that says, even if you see no vehicle available, if you want a vehicle, please make a request. And if people start doing that, then we can get a better sense of how often people actually want WAVE service and it's not available.
Yes,
is that
absolutely
correct?
I thought that was a very good idea.
Okay. The other thing, though, is that we frankly do not have a great history of enforcement of WAVE availability for private for hire industry, period. I mean, a year ago, we couldn't have told you that we were doing lots of monitoring of availability of WAVE taxis, and they were available all hours of the day in all parts of the city. But when we decided to authorize TNCs in the city, it was with the understanding that you were going to be providing WAVE service and 24/7 citywide service. And by your own admission, you haven't been doing that. So I want to know two things. One, how close are you to that now? And why shouldn't we assess penalties for the period within which you actually haven't been in compliance with that requirement?
If we go back to the pilot rules, we are in compliance with those pilot rules and looking about availability and response times. We tried as hard as possible to meet those. Those were based on averages. So I just want to be clear that that was what was set out on the pilot terms.
Well, my recollection is that the rules acknowledge that you might have differential response times between waves and non-waves, but still required that you have some sort of coverage, 24/7 wave coverage. And it's my understanding that, admittedly, for big chunks of time during the week, at least until recently, you simply had no coverage available at all.
So I do want to go back to that question about supply. The question is, how many wave vehicles are there in the city of Portland, and how many are available at any given moment of the week? I think that is a critical question, because that is how we can have those partnerships.
You mean across all providers?
Across all providers, yes.
Right, but absolutely. You could have chosen not to start operating until you knew the answer to that question and could provide 24/7 citywide wave service.
Ms. Sager, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, actually, I think the fact that we are operating while there are gaps and there are problems actually has allowed us to better, I believe that there is better wheelchair accessible data than there ever has been in this city. It has allowed us to understand where the needs of the community are. It has allowed us to build a P2P wave product, which we would have never been able to build here in the city if we weren't operating here. So actually, I think that this has actually, and it's allowed us to sit on the subcommittees and provide feedback and understand the needs of the community. So I think doing it and starting it and starting to learn is actually better than not doing it at all. And I think we've made some huge strides here. And I think what the subcommittee proposed by having a fund is a very, very good step in the right direction. But I don't think we should just not offer service to anyone because our service cannot be perfect. I think that we should learn from it and we should iterate off of it and grow from it and continue to make the service levels for both, for everyone, and no matter who you are, better.
How quickly do you think you can implement that idea of if you turn on the app and it's you're seeking wave service, it tells you, I think as soon as you open the app, it says if you're seeking wave service, actually request a ride, don't just look at what the map shows you.
We'll have that done by the end of the week.
All right. So I guess just in your defense, I thought I heard Jody Yates say that the data shows that wave requests for Uber or Lyft are responded to in about 12 minutes.
That is
whereas
correct.
For taxis, it's 23 minutes.
That is correct.
Okay, yes. So something's working here. It's maybe not perfect, but I've heard a lot of people from the disability community express a lot of satisfaction with the entrance of Uber and Lyft into the market. Anyway, I just want to get that out there. I just wanted to ask you, who is the for each one of you, who is your local agent of service, and what is their phone number?
So, that depends on are you talking about a legal agent of service?
I'm talking about what was agreed to under the trial period rules.
Each
company is supposed to have a local agent of service along with a local phone number and regular hours of business.
Yes,
so,
that's correct.
Who is that for?
I believe that's in our permit information. I don't have that right off the top of my head.
Does somebody with you here have that information?
Let's try to get that while we're having the hearing. Same
yeah,
with you.
I have
can get that while you're having, while
yeah,
having
I'm
the hearing.
Not responsible for setting up our local agents of service, but I can, of course, get that to you. I will also point out that we do have a permanent office with employees here, though we typically do not offer phone support. We do offer 24/7 email and social media support. We also have support via the app. You can
the rules you're operating under right now require a local
absolutely.
Agent and a phone number.
And I know that we do have a local agent, and we're happy to get you their name and contact information.
Phone number. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Other requests? Thank you both very much. Let's move along. We next want to call taxi driver Darren Campbell.
Good afternoon. Mr. Mayor, members of the commission, under council rules, I am a registered lobbyist with Radio Cab. However, today I represent the 2,200 plus cab drivers as a private hire transportation taxi driver representative. You know, after seeing some of the discussion already today, I can go in about 100 different directions, so I'm a little conflicted. But I want to really, push the importance of proper insurance on the industry. And when you say that there, when Uber says that there's a policy out there that's been written, that's been approved by state and state and state, it hasn't been by this state, and they want to impress upon you that they will not get an insurance policy unless it's of their choosing. There's policies out there, and if, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think the fair thing to do would be to have them be registered as commercial vehicles and have the same exact coverage of taxi cabs. Period one is not just people sitting around at home watching TV, drinking coffee. A lot of the time, it's vehicles trying to get back down to a high area of call volumes in between calls. Sometimes it's the most dangerous driving that a professional driver does because their income depends on it. With that being said, I also had an opportunity to sit on the subcommittees during phase two. From the taxi cab side, we were insistent that caps needed to be in place on vehicles for both the taxi industry and the TNC industry. It's oversaturation of the market. And you'll notice that there's a huge decrease in volume of Uber and Lyft drivers in this room right now. And that's because they've started to become dissatisfied. I talk to every single Uber and Lyft driver that I can possibly get within talking distance to. And in the last number of weeks, they're saying there's less and less orders, there's more saturation, there's more drivers on the road, less orders per vehicle. What that's going to do is that's going to drop service. That's going to make it more unsafe with less professional drivers on the road. And then at the last part of that, you're going to have less quality of driver. You're going to end up with shorter-term drivers who can't make a living driving, and so you're going to have a revolving door of drivers and constantly have rookies on the road. Now, one of my other roles is a safety committee chairman at Radio Cab. Whenever we put on a bunch of new drivers, our accidents go up. It's always the new drivers that have issues, and if we have this revolving door, we're going to have issues there. I've got a whole lot of other things that I really want to put out there. I guess I can do that via email, unless you want to set up a meeting time now, Commissioner Novick. I'd be more than happy to meet with you on some other things. There are three more cab companies coming to town for another 250 permits. United, Independent, Rainbow Cab, and PDX Yellow or something like that. So it's not
planning to start operations, you mean?
Correct. They were authorized by Commissioner Novick at the beginning of the 120 trial. They were passed by the Private Hire Transportation Board. At that time, when they were passed, they were supposed to come to City Council. However, the rules changed on who approved those, so they were just green-lighted by Commissioner Novick. I've seen the United Independent Cabs painted, a couple of them. We've seen the Yellow PDX. I have yet to see the Rainbow Cab. So they're out there. They're getting ready, getting geared up. PBOT could probably tell us how close they are to actually getting plates, but they're putting cars into service.
Are we charging them a permit?
One last thing. Brooke Steiger was very clear on saying that their P2P service was the first worldwide put here in Portland. So why can't Portland be the first one worldwide to put caps on TNCs? There's a lot of things here in Portland that we can do for the first time on TNCs that would be innovative. They would be seen as incredibly intelligent, and they would probably make this traffic system a great deal better. And I'm the first one to admit that we have improvements that need to be made. So with that, I will take any questions you may have.
I just want to encourage you. You said that you had a lot of other points you wanted to make, and all of us read our mail. So since this trial period is being extended, I hope you'll send your comments, comments in writing, because they will be read.
Absolutely, and I admit I'm horrible at it, but I'm going to make a point of it. One thing I know that I talked to Commissioner Fritz before this meeting. I know that Noah Ernst from Radio Cab sent out a packet in regards to insurance. It was very informative on what's going on across the country right now with Uber, TNCs, drivers, personal insurance. I'd encourage you to really do an in-depth look at that, and I'm sure that you all have that. If not,
yeah, I do want to encourage people. Yeah, again, keep that kind of material coming because we will read it.
I'm interested to hear that there's three new taxi cabs coming. One of the guiding principles, according to the task force, is the ability for taxi and TNC companies, drivers, to earn a living wage.
It's becoming more and more impossible. And every single day I hear of another cab driver that's got to leave this industry because they cannot make it.
So that's my question. It's my understanding in other cities there are medallion systems. There are other mechanisms to ensure that, for taxis at least, drivers are able to earn a full-time wage. Are there any other cities that are just letting taxis be completely? I mean, what other cities allow unlimited numbers of taxis?
You know, you could look at every city and look at a totally different taxi model. There's so many different types of taxi models out there.
We're not going to have any taxi model, right?
Yeah. And even in the city of Portland, to answer the question of employment, you know, you have EcoCab that's employee-driven. You rode with them. There's Rainbow Cab is coming. They're going to be employee-driven. You know, if you want to do some sort of quasi-independent employee status that's some sort of hybrid, I think that needs to be left up to the federal government. But right now we have enough options for the driver to be able to go to a company that might fit their needs as an employee or independent contractor. And you've seen the data. Taxi drivers can go either way on that question. Some want the extra added incentives of being an employee, and they're willing to trade off their lack of freedom to do that. Then there's those that want the freedom, are willing to take the lack of all those incentives for the freedom.
Commissioner, I've been hoping to find some way that through regulation we can improve working conditions for drivers other than continuing to give a monopoly to a limited number of companies, because I just don't think that giving monopolies to companies is the best way to protect workers. I mean, Walmart has monopoly status in a lot of small towns, but that does not mean they pay their workers well.
Commissioner, one of the ways, though, in a prior council that we addressed this issue was we made it possible for a group of employees to start Union Cab. And they were folks that wanted to work on improving terms and conditions of employment. They were very intentional. They wanted to be employees, and they wanted to maximize their rights under federal state law. One of the things that troubles me is that we keep being told there's anecdotal evidence that people want to be independent contractors. We're told, we understand from the business model, that there are enormous advantages for these technology / transportation companies to classify people as independent contractors, but it comes at a significant sacrifice of people's rights under state and federal law, and that includes the right to organize collectively to improve working conditions. So I find that deeply ironic.
But of course, the taxis have generally treated people as independent contractors too, and so your concern extends to the industry before the advent of TNCs as well as after.
No, but I'm pointing out that the Union Cab permit and the organizing around Union Cab was specifically designed to address this. I mean, that was something the AFL got behind because they were hoping it would actually raise the working conditions for the industry. I agree that there were anomalies before. I just don't want to make sure that we make it worse.
It's not that there were anomalies. It's that there was no requirement before that taxi cabs treat drivers as employees, period. I mean, there might have been one or two that did, but it wasn't a requirement.
Okay.
Can I make one more?
Yeah.
In regards to the payments that Mr. Antler brought up in regards to what's due in August, a very fair thing to do would be to roll those back to 2012 prices, which were $150 per cab. The whole reason for that increase from $150 per plate to $600 was increased enforcement, which we saw none. We saw more paper pushing. Zero increase in enforcement. It would be really easy to go back to those prices, probably keep the staff levels the same. They've added a couple employees during that time. However, they were absorbed by PBOT. They lost Frank DeFay. I don't know where they're at there, but I can't imagine that they're utilizing that much more money on staffing of not doing what they said they were going to do with the increase.
And what's this, the cat? What does the board suggest that we do with these new companies? Are we going to, what are we going to charge them?
You know what? The Private Hire Transportation Board has not met since Commissioner Novick has taken over the powers of that board. So we're useless in regards to that's concerned. My guess is that they were going to come in at that $600 per plate charge, just like every other taxi cab in the city. I'm sure that Ron Norrie's here. He could probably testify that EcoCab is paying $600 per plate on the 15 or 16 units they just put on at EcoCab.
So, colleagues, this is clearly something we have to fix soon. We can't wait till October to fix this.
And the other thing with that payment, it's different at different cab companies. I just talked to testify. He pays for all his...